Grab a seat, everybody. How are we doing this morning? All right. That's encouraging. Hey, my name is Charlie. I'm a pastor on staff here. It's good to be here this morning. We're going to dive right in. We spent the summer going through questions that we all have together, and today is one of my favorites. We are asking today, what is our response to how do I, as a Christian, respond to culture? That question is loaded, right? If there's any question we as a Christian family on mission with Christ need to ask and answer is what exactly is our role in a culture that every blog I read tells me is going straight to hell without passing go, you know? What do we do in that space? How do we respond to a culture that's growing less and less in the ways of Jesus? So today we're going to sit here and talk about it. What, I mean, do we just build bigger buildings, have more lock-ins, and rent more Kirk Cameron flicks, right? I really hope not. I love Mike Seaver, but come on, man. So what I want to do is talk a little bit about our response to culture this morning. And we're going to do it in a couple ways. We're going to get pretty quickly to why we're supposed to respond and then maybe what it looks like. So, but to start, let's start by defining culture, just to get on the same page. We're going to say that culture is the shared attitudes, values, and practices of the people around you. Pretty simple. Pretty much everything anybody does around you that's not a biological necessity, right, is the culture we create. And there's culture that we create, and there's culture that we don't. When I first got to Crossroads, I walked in downstairs, and if you guys know me, you know I'm not a huge game, let's play games, goofy, silly game guy. So I took a job as a middle school pastor. That was probably an oversight, but I took a job as a middle school pastor, and I walk in the room downstairs, and one of the things they had was they had a wall of video games, like old arcade games, NFL Blitz and some other ones, and one of the first things I did was I just got rid of all of those, right? It's actually really pretty fantastic. One of my favorite memories is the students walk in the next week and there's no video games and they stare at that blank space in their life like something went seriously wrong and they lost a puppy. And they'd look at me and said, what are we supposed to do? And I said, talk to each other, right? I might even speak in Chinese because they just stood there awkwardly and said, I don't know what that looks like, right? The point is that we create cultures, and I wanted to create a culture of people talking to each other in church, and I feel like that didn't happen if you're playing Blitz by yourself, you know? And so we sometimes create the culture around us. You do with your family, and probably most primarily, and other times we're brought into a culture. Other times it's not our decision as a whole, either because we've lost the majority, or we just don't have the weight or pull anymore. And so I think that the question that's kind of resonating underneath this whole thing is, hey, the bigger picture of our culture in America now isn't moving towards Christ. So what do we do? The culture that is created by the rhythms of people isn't moving towards Christ. So what do we do? Really, do we yell a lot? Do we stand up and tell them they're wrong? Do we do nothing? Do we just retreat and do the whole monastic movement, let's move into a castle thing and chant a lot after we shave our heads? What's the response to culture? I was talking to a couple students, old students of mine this week. When I say old students, I mean 21-year-olds, but old students this week. And I said, yeah, why do we, what's the purpose of us engaging in culture? And we're talking back and forth, and they said, well, to make disciples. And I said, yeah, that's not the purpose. That's the what, that's not the why. And so today what I want to do is really focus for the first bit on the why, because I think it's really important. There's a TED Talk that I love by a guy named Simon Sisnick, and it's one of the top 10, I think, all time. But he's going to talk about business leadership, and he's going to say that great leaders in business always call people into the why and not the what. And so it looks like this. He uses some computer companies, I believe, in his TED Talk. He says, you know, there's some companies that say, we make computers, you know, yay, come get a computer. We sell them this kind and this kind and this kind. And then he picks on Apple because Apple's better in taking over the world. But he picks on Apple and he says, here's what Apple's sales pitch is. We believe in quality. We believe in design. We believe in simplicity. We believe in excellence. We happen to make computers, right? I'm buying from that company. They sold the why over the what. We try to do it here. So, hey, it's not just we have stuff happening on Wednesday nights, but we need to be leaders in our community. We need to be, because the gospel is going forth and we're called to jump in to our community. So because we need to be leaders, we have some classes on Wednesdays, right? When I'm writing high school emails about what we do, it's not just, hey, we have a pool party. It's we show the gospel one cannonball at a time. Come, please don't drown each other, you know? We speak to the why behind the what. And here's why I think that matters, is because I think if we find our purpose in our culture, if we answer that why question, it is going to tell us how we do it. It's going to tell us how we speak into and the posture we should take, right? So I want to start by looking at the why. And to do that, we're going to be in Genesis 1 just to start. If you have a Bible, open it to Genesis 1. If not, it's on the screen. I was talking to my intern and I said, yeah, I think laying out how this thing is going to go this week. We're kicking it back and forth. And he said, where are you going to go? And I said, well, I think I'm going to start in Genesis 1. And apparently I go here a lot. And so he said, really? Again? And my former intern thinks that. Kidding, he's a good dude. But some people are like, wow, that gets you fired. No, it takes a lot less than that. Anyway, but seriously, I told him this is why I love Genesis 1. It's because Genesis 1 is this beautiful piece of poetry that reflects a God at the ultimate, like, pinnacle of creativity. And what we do when we read this is we're more of a linear culture, a pragmatic, give me the facts kind of Trivial Pursuit people, you know? We're afraid of the pop quiz even when we're adults all the time. And so when we read a text, instead of look at it as poetry and as a bigger picture unfolding, expressing the goodness and the characteristics of God, we memorize, what did God do on day one? What did God do on day two? And we ask questions like, what did God do on day three? Well, he created vegetation, right? Instead, I love Genesis 1 because it is a beautiful expression of the characteristics of God that we see over and over and over again in each subsequent day. So what that means is, instead of asking what happened on day three, because the text is poetry and filled with beauty, we should maybe be asking, hey, how did what God do on day three show us more of what he values in his creativity? So instead of just vegetation, right, we get a different answer that opens us up the character of God a little bit. This is Genesis 1. It provides us this glimpse into a God who's majestic and who's mighty and who creates. It's a really beautiful picture of the God that we serve. And what it does, up into verse 26, it talks about how creation will show us how amazing God is. That's its purpose, right? I mean, even this last week, I don't know if you guys have been following it, but we launched a satellite about 10 years ago, and it just now got to Pluto. And it's really fantastic if you look at any of the pictures. 10 years ago, we launched a rocket. It just got to Pluto. And for the first time now, we have pictures of Pluto from about 7,000 miles away. It's a big deal. NASA geeks are freaking out. It's really fun, right? So what I love is that as we read through the narrative, the poetry of Genesis 1, it reflects on the character of God that is ultimately expressed in creativity and in goodness and in majesty and in awe and in bigness, you know? And what I told my intern was, I love Genesis 1 because it ultimately gives us purpose and it gives us identity. So go to 126. Let me show you what I'm talking about. He says in 126, after he'd made everything else, he comes to you and me. It's a pretty familiar verse. He said, then God said, let us make humankind, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea, the birds over the air, over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move on the earth. What we see, when I said it gives us identity and purpose, it says, let us make humankind after our image. There's our identity, so that, here comes the purpose, they may rule over all of this stuff. And in ruling over all this stuff, our relationship is different than that of creation. Creation just exists and shines back to God. We show the glory of God not only in our existence, but in how we relate to everything else that was created. The way that we rule shows the beauty of God. So it comes to this first pretty basic point that we were created. Our purpose in creation was to reflect God to all of the creation. That was why we were created. That's the why in the first place. We were created to reflect God to the culture around us and how we led and how we ruled. We've talked a bit about my friends now being at the life stage that I'm at, deciding it's a good idea to make more little children, you know, and how that drastically changes my relationships with them because they're selfish people. And yesterday I had the chance to do something I've never done before. So one of my best friends is in town because his sister's getting married today. And he has like a 13-year-old baby, right? And so he's in town and there's things are pretty stressful. So the only chance I got to see the kid, there's a sip and see, like a little baby shower thing on Monday. But we live in the South, so guys can't go to those. So my wife's going, but I wanted to see little Wesley because I just think babies are fascinating. And so the only time I could do that because everything was going on was he said, hey, I'm going to go on a little power walk with Wesley. Come and join me, right? So he's got a place in Dallas that they rented out. And literally, yesterday morning, I meet a friend of mine, and he, me, stroller, little Wesley, we're power walking around Dallas, you know, with this little baby. That's right. People were staring at us. Pretty sure we got an applause or two. Thank you. I like attention. I didn't refute any of it. That's right, everybody. Hard life. But anyway, it was a really beautiful thing. And as I'm looking at my friend and his 13-day-old kid, all I can think about is not just that this kid even being here expresses the creativity and the goodness of God, but his responsibility now is to show that in how he parents his kid. It's a different layer to purpose. Don't just exist, but show in action as you have the authority over somebody else that God is good, that God is creative, that God is beautiful, that God is majestic, that God is vast, that God loves. And that's his job, and he's woefully underqualified because I think every first-time parent is, but he'll learn as he goes. So when we talk about our purpose to culture, to that stuff around us, we have to start with, hey, at the very, very beginning, our purpose has always been to reflect God to the culture around us and how we treated it and how we led. And we see that, you know, in different ways. So that's what we were created to do. That's the why of kind of the initial start to things. But as we well know, things didn't hold up like that. Sin entered the world. And that changed our purpose in culture a little bit as Christians. That changed our role. So what I mean by that is if everything was created to glorify God and that's all it did because the world was perfect, as sin entered and flourished in our world, the culture that was only intended to glorify God moved away from that more and more and more. The culture that was meant to only show the beauty of its creator didn't as much. And so then as Christians, as people that follow the ways of God, as people that try to get back to the creation that God intended at the beginning as we reign and rule or lead or, you know, mentor, our role changes a little bit. And I want to know why that is. I want to know why God even has the church here anymore, you know? Because we're a pragmatic culture. So be saved, live life, get to heaven. That's the purpose of the gospel, right? Why do we even exist in culture anymore? Is it a good idea to just wrap everything up, move to the hills somewhere, meditate on scripture all day, and say, I love you, Lord, right? What's the purpose of the Christian in the culture? Go to 2 Corinthians 5 for me. I love 2 Corinthians 5. 2 Corinthians 5 is one of those texts that we usually just quote the end, which I'm going to do. But I love 2 Corinthians 5 because of the context of the culture that Paul is writing to. So sometimes we run into people that are going to sit here and tell me as a pastor, and look, I'm not doubting that culture is moving away from the rhythms and the ways of God, but we are nowhere near catastrophic moral, you know, evil yet, right? We're probably not good, but you know, some of the more extreme Christians out there are going to say that we're one step away from Nineveh, you know? And I just don't think we have context if we say that. Do any studying on ancient Rome or ancient Greece, and you'll realize that our culture, we are saints comparatively. Now, that doesn't make us good. I'm not arguing that's an okay place to be. I'm just simply saying that all hope isn't lost yet in our culture. And if we don't understand that, then sometimes we overreact. So, for example, Paul is writing to a Christian culture here, a church in the midst of the city of Corinth. And Corinth was horrible. I mean, deplorable culture. Corinth was a trade city. It was huge, about 20 times the size of Athens, had about 250-ish thousand people. It was right on the port, and so sailors would come in and change their goods out and leave. It was a transient city as well. And what they were known for, what Corinth was known for, was this temple of Aphrodite, the Roman god of love. This temple of Aphrodite that stood on the top of this flat-top mountain that was 2,000 feet up that looked over the city. And you would go there, and you would find a partner, and the culture was seeping with immorality. It was so bad that by the third or fourth year before Christ and around that era, they came up with a word to describe its own, evilness. And you know you're bad if you're getting your own word, right? So we make up words all the time to describe social movements. Just Google it. That's one of them, because they slowly are taking over the world with Apple. But in this culture, there was literally a word called Corinthianize, and that meant to be exceedingly sexually immoral. It was a terrible place. And so Paul writes to this church in the middle of this very, very making us look like saints wicked culture and says, hey, how do you guys respond in the middle of that? Right? So let's pick it up in chapter 5. I'm going to read verse 18 and on, and we're going to go through verse 20. Now all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. Namely, that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them. And he has committed to us the word of reconciliation. Verse 20, therefore, we are ambassadors for Christ, as through God, God were making an appeal through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. What I love about this is at the very beginning, in verse 18 and 19, what we see is this idea of reconciliation, right? So he's literally saying at the beginning of it, all these things are from God. Who God did the action here reconciled us to himself, not that we did it, through Christ. He's the medium, the agent through which that happens. Namely, God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. It's this idea that God is calling creation back to its intended purposes. That's what reconciling means, to bring back to original intent, purpose, or design, right? So God is reconciling through the work of Christ the world to himself. Here's where we come in, verse 20. Therefore, given the screens, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were making his plea through us. We pled with you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. I love that phrase, God, we're making his plea through us. Literally, a better translation there would be as if God were begging you, the culture, through you and I. So there's a show that I don't watch, but I was talking about with some kids this week, America's Got Talent, right? And you watch that show and you weep for our culture. But outside of that, there's some pretty great things that happen. And I guess last week, one of the guys on the show, the judge, is very much OCD germaphobe. And Howie Mandel, bald head guy, he won't touch things that he doesn't know. He fist bumps everything. He's very much afraid of germs and lives in a Germex bathtub when he's not in public, that kind of sort of OCD. I guess there was a hypnotist that got up there, and he called Howie on stage doing his little I have talent bit, and he hypnotized Howie, and long story short, I guess the guy at the end of it was like shaking hands and kissing babies and, you know, like licking dirt, like, yeah, life is good. Anyway, so the people, because they knew that Howie was incredibly OCD, they were floored by this hypnotist because of the change that he made in this man. Literally, this hypnotist was begging the people to see his talent, his goodness, his qualities of worth because of the work that he did in Howie. When God says, you are my ambassadors, I am begging people through you, that's what we get here. That as we live in our culture, as we interact with other people, as God shows his ability to transform, that is him begging everything around us to be reconciled. What it lends it to is, so not only is our job to reflect God in creation, but through Christ, we're now called to redeem the culture around us. We reflect, and now because of sin and the changes, we are called to redeem it. That's a big change. That's a huge why. I think that sometimes we don't kind of know how that works itself out. This idea of redeeming culture, you know, the how is tough. And a lot of times if we're not paying attention, we don't work it out well. So the question is, if now we're called to reflect, not only to reflect, but to redeem the culture around us, what does that look like? If you go back to, the fifth chapter of 2 Corinthians, and it says that we pled with you on Christ's behalf. Literally, that word pled is one of my favorites. It's parakaleo in the Greek, which means literally para, along with or near, right? And then kaleo, to call. So what he's saying is, this is how we do it. We come alongside of, we draw near to the culture that we're around, and we whisper to them, hey, Christ is better. We come alongside with them and say, hey, there is a better way. Plea with them by becoming, by getting next to them and calling them into the work of Jesus that's transformed you. Nearness is intrinsic to the idea of the word Paul used here. And the problem with this, and what we do, is sometimes we mistake redeeming culture for, you know, behavior modification. We mistake our role as redeemers of cultures for our role as judge and jury of culture. And what that looks like is, instead of drawing near, we feel like it's our responsibility to call out sin all the time. And sometimes it is. That's not what we're talking about. But sometimes, though, sometimes we're called to draw near, and maybe our job, our number one job, isn't to tell the world that it's going to hell as fast as it possibly can. Because we're called to redeem, not be behavior modificators, right? Of the place that we're in, of the culture that we live in. There was an article this week in Relevant Magazine, and he actually wrote about this idea. I have a quote for you that I really like. He says, "We were never commissioned to demand that sexual culture reflect biblical principles. We were commissioned to reflect biblical principles in the middle of secular culture, pointing to God's redemptive story. We're not supposed to babysit culture and be the morality police, right? We're not supposed to sit there and say, you don't look enough like Jesus. We're supposed to get into life with people and say, Jesus offers you a better life, and always point back to the redemptive story that Christ is developing in you and in me and hopefully in them. There's a difference between those two. If we're after behavior modification, I can buy that, and that changes. Redemption, redeeming, changes the intrinsic motivation behind the action in the first place. If I'm redeemed, I don't want to move away from God anymore. If I'm redeemed, I want to run towards the ways of God. That's what we're called to call people into. We're not some, you know, babysitter on culture that's supposed to sit there and say, hey, you're doing it wrong. We're called to live inside of and to help as God redeems culture through Christ, as people get to see how great he is through you and me. So let's look at how that looks. Go to Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2 is one of my favorite stories in the New Testament. It's Jesus, and he's walking around for a bit, and he finds a tax collector. And why I like this story here is we're going to get to see really Christ's response to culture and then the Pharisees' response to culture, and we're going to draw some implications out of that for how we're supposed to respond. So let me read 2:14 through 17, all in one big foul swoop, and then we'll dive into it. Verse 14. As he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth. He said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in the house, and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples. For there were many of them, and they were all following him. When the scribes and Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" And hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It's not only those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but to call the sinners." So where this text starts is this idea of Christ engaging with people, and he engages with a tax collector. And if you guys don't know, tax collectors were the most hated profession in all of the Jewish culture, because they would sit at the gates of cities, and they would take from the Jews what was theirs and give to the Romans who were oppressing the Jews, and then steal some for themselves. Tax collectors were hated because literally all they did was steal from their people, give to the people that were beating up their people, and get rich in the process, right? And in a really community-driven culture, man, that is nothing short of betrayal. You are going to the enemy and saying, hey, how can I help you and help myself at the expense of my family? Tax collectors were absolutely the most looked down upon, and for good reason. They betrayed their people every single day with their job so that they could have a better life, right? And so Jesus, in the middle of this, walks up to some tax collectors, to this guy Levi, and says, come and follow me. And what he means by that is come and become who I am. Join me in my movement. Come and walk with me and learn from me. Do life with me. Follow me. And then he comes and he sits in his house and he has some dinner with him. And I love that he sit and he had some dinner. Dinner was a big deal back then. It usually took all night. You sat with your friends. You didn't eat with people that you didn't want to invest in, you know? We didn't just go and pick up fast food at a drive-thru and call it a night. It was a more intimate experience. So we have to ask the question, how is Jesus responding to his culture? He goes to one of the most looked down upon, and then he goes to his house and eats. And I think the first thing we can pick up on from this text about how we engage culture is fundamentally that very fact that we need to, we are called to engage the culture around us. Nothing short of that. We are called to engage the culture around us. I think it's really easy to get locked into church groups and forget that there are people out there that need Jesus. Because if we really come side by side with tax collectors and people that don't share our values or our morals, we're scared that it might rub off on us, and rightfully so. It's a scary place to be. Those people, they don't love the Lord. Those people, I can't trust them. Those people, they're sinning. But the first thing we see Jesus do is stop down, go into the house of, and engage with the culture around him, as wicked as it might have been. That's a huge moment. I was talking to, in the same conversation with the students, and one of them looked at me, and she said, you know, I think that if all we do is go to church and learn more about the Bible and then share the stuff we learned about the Bible with the people in the church with us, we're doing something wrong. And I'd agree. It's this idea that we get in these holy huddles with other people around us, and we never see outside of that. It's this idea that we don't engage the culture around us. Because if our purpose, if the why is to redeem it, if that's why we're still here, then we have to engage it. Look at what the Pharisees did. Verse 16, when the scribes and Pharisees saw that he was eating and drinking with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, why is he eating and drinking with them? And I get that point. They didn't like those people. They were wicked people. They were evil people. And they valued the laws of God. But I think that the tax collectors missed the purpose of why they were there, was to bring people back towards God and not just to tell them that they were doing it wrong. There's a book that I read a couple weeks ago by a lady named Rachel Held Evans. And she is, some people like her, some people don't. You're probably going to agree and disagree with some of her theology, but she wrote this book called Searching for Sundays, and it's really good. She grew up in the tribe, in the church, and she's kind of fallen out of favor with it a little bit. And this is her book on, hey, should I go to church? How has my interaction been with church? How have churches treated me and my family? So for that part, it's really, really good just to kind of see into that. She's a good writer. She says this, because we religious types are really good at building walls and retreating to temples, we're good at making mountains out of our ideologies, obstructions out of our theologies, and hills out of our screwed up notions of who's in and who's out, who's worthy and who's unworthy. We're good at getting in the way. Perhaps we're afraid that if we move, God might use people and methods we don't approve of, that rules will be broken and theologies questioned. Perhaps we're afraid that if we get out of the way, this grace thing might get out of hand. I really like what she said there. These Pharisees walk by and they're engaging with culture in two very different ways. Jesus is in the middle of speaking into, and the Pharisees are on the outside of speaking at. And the why behind what we do in culture changes our posture. In one sense, we sit there and say, you guys aren't doing it right, and we're outside of speaking at. And the other one, Jesus says, get inside of it and speak into it. As Corinthians says, draw close and call people into with your lives. Very different approaches. But this is one thing we know, is that Jesus calls us to engage in culture. And look, here's the deal. I don't really care if you like Kirk Cameron movies and KLTY, right? Good for you. There's beautiful stuff in there sometimes. But I think that fundamentally, man, we have to ask the motivation behind our desire for those things. If we're using that to distance ourselves from the things that we don't understand or are afraid of, then we're not using it right. If we're using that to separate ourselves from the culture that Christ calls us to engage in and redeem, then I think we're missing the purpose behind why we're here. Jesus sat down with, ate a meal, and engaged. He sat down with, ate a meal with, and said, hey, how can I speak into your life, not at your life? That's what I love about the Gospels. That's what he does with you and me still now. He sticks through my muddy bits and says, hey, let's keep going. So the first thing we do, absolutely the first thing we do, is we engage culture. The second thing that I really like about this is, if you look at it, verse 17. Hearing this, Jesus said to them, so they questioned his motivation, and Jesus is about to give them the why. He says, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but I came to call the sinners. The second thing I think of, we talk about how we relate to culture. If our purpose is to redeem it, we first of all engage it. And then the second thing we do, I think is really important, is we be known for what we stand for, not for what we stand against. We're known for what we stand for and not for what we stand against. This is what Jesus did. You had Pharisees on the outside saying, we don't like this, we don't like this, we don't like this, we don't like this. And Jesus says, no, I came so that you might have life. I think this is really tough because it's really easy to be critical. It's really easy to make broad sweeping statements on social media about things that we hate and that the Lord hates too. But over time, we have to ask the question, how are we seen in culture? Are we seen as a people who are building into, that take a stand for the life that Christ gives us and calls us into, or are we seen for all those things that God hates? Those are different, fundamentally different motivators if our goal is redemption. If our goal is to redeem the people around us. There was a pastor in Denver, and he wrote an article about this as well, and I really liked his quote. He says, there are times when we must cry out against injustice and call for an end to corruption, but I hope that's not all we do. I hope we remember the best form of protest is to stand for something better. Here's the tough part to wrestle with is just because we don't in every way tell everybody how they're doing stuff wrong, it doesn't mean that we allow it, right? So just because we are known for what we stand for and not against doesn't mean that we're soft on sin. It doesn't mean that we don't care about sin. It doesn't mean that we don't tell people in relationship, hey, this isn't God's ways for your life. That's not loving at all if we believe that God's ways are the most loving way to live. Absolutely not. We don't compromise the scriptures. We don't compromise the standards of God if we believe that he set those out for flourishment, for joy, and for goodness. But the question we have to back up and ask is, if our job is to redeem culture, are we really standing known for what we're standing for instead of what we're standing against? And I don't know. I know sometimes I have to wrestle with that one, you know? Sometimes I have to remind myself, hey, man, God did the same for me, to sit and eat a meal with somebody every once in a while, even though I disagree with them about a lot of things, even though they don't look like me and they scare me. We want to be known for what we stand for, because that's how we breathe life into the world around us. As we say, the gospel is the power to overcome and to change and to give life. That's what Jesus did. That's what he did here, and that's what he did with all his disciples. The Pharisees were always the ones saying, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong, you're doing it wrong. And Jesus, for the most part, was the one saying, hey, I've come so that you might find the right way to do things. Follow. Because he's after motivation change. He's after redemption. The Pharisees, they just wanted people to look and act like they love the law. The fundamental difference in how they engage the culture around them. And then finally, I think it all goes back to this last point. Is that at the end of the day, always, always, always remember the incarnation. Always. So the incarnation, this idea that God became flesh and came and lived among us. If you could just think for a second about what it was like for God to sit at that table, for all the things that happened, had to happen along the way for God to sit at that table. Go back to 2 Corinthians 5 for me. We're going to end with this verse. In verse 21, so we have this movement in 2 Corinthians 5 about Paul talking to the people in the middle of the culture. He says, hey, know that God is reconciling. He's in the business of doing that. And know that you're still here now so that you can be the begging point for people to see how great God is. And then in the end of it, in verse 21, he says, God made the one. This is how it happens. God made the one who knew no sin to be sin for us so that we would become the righteousness of God. What I love about the gospel is essentially that the gospel redefines things for me because I need that done. I need things redefined. So Jesus comes into our world and says, yeah, where there was evil, I'm going to say there is good here now. There is hope where there wasn't before. He does it with little things and big things. He does it with little things like bread and wine. He picks up some bread and some wine, and it wasn't magical. And he says, every time now you see this, it has way deeper meaning because of me. This is my body. This is my blood. He did it with church. There was already gatherings that hailed Caesar in that culture. He said, take them over and give them a new identity. Call them Iglesia and move on and worship God with them. He did it over and over and over again. And he did it with people, right? With Peter, he said, I know you're a fisherman. I want to show you a different way to fish that has more substance and value than you ever thought was possible. He gives new identity where there was none before. This is the gospel. Is he came and he dwelt among us and he said, there is hope. That's the point of the incarnation. That's why he came. I was in Romania a week and a half ago. And there was a sports camp and there was about 115 kids. And all these kids were anywhere between 12 and 17-ish. There's about 25 leaders. And they were all ranging from, the youngest was 16 and the oldest was, I think, 23. The head of this whole show, this whole sports camp in Romania, was 34. And then you got this one guy named George, right? George was 37 or 38, I think. And he was a counselor there. And he was a part-time chef, too, at the camp. And he lived at the camp. And he followed that camp around all summer long. He didn't have a family. He didn't have a wife. It was just him, right? So George gave his testimony one night. The cool thing about last week in our group that went there was out of the 100 kids, about half of them came from orphanages in the area, which is really cool to think about. So we get up there and we're doing our testimonies and we talk about family and God the good father. And I'm sure that when they heard those things, they probably didn't have very high regard for family or fathers or mothers at that point, you know? So George gets up to give his testimony and he doesn't speak English, actually, so it's just all in Romanian. And you just start seeing people start to cry. And I look over, and I'm standing next to the camp director who's heard this testimony probably about 300 times. And he starts wiping a little something away from his eye. And as usual, I'm the only one in the room not crying, and I feel cold-hearted. But I look around, I start to see even like our American counselors start crying. They didn't even know what he was saying. Crying's just contagious. So they start crying, and I'm like, it's everywhere at this point. And begin to ask what George was talking about. George was an orphan too, I found out. And when you're an orphan in Romania, when you turn 18, they simply just kick you out of the orphanage. You don't have anywhere to go. You don't have family because you're an orphan. You just got to figure it out. So George was, and he got kicked out, and he was homeless for a long time. And then he found the Lord and started getting in, met Julian and started working at the camp a little bit. Here's my point. Why I think that was so moving was because he got there and he says, hey, I know you think you know what a father is, and believe me, I had bad feelings toward fathers too, but there's a better one. George helped these kids redefine family and father and mother in a way that they needed, in a way that only the gospel brought. And why I like George is because the 37 or 8-year-old man that did this, that lived in this camp, that didn't have anybody in his life stage, that didn't have anybody that was around his age at all, why he chose to do this was because this was important to him because he wanted kids to hear it. So he came and he got into the middle of the craziness that is the teenage life as a 30-some-odd-year-old man and said it's worth living in the middle of this so that they can hear the gospel. That's incarnation. He got in the middle of it and he said, let me speak life into you guys. I will live with you. I will walk with you. I will cook for you. So ultimately, when we talk about our posture towards culture, if our job isn't just to exist side by side, if our job isn't to be morality police, if our job is to ultimately redeem the culture and change the motivations of the people therein so that they might see the life that Christ brings, our ultimate example of that is the incarnation of Christ, who came so that we may have life. And he had dinner with people that were sinners, and he called people that were not great people, and he walked alongside them, he drew them near, and he whispered about the good things that only he can bring. That's the beauty of the incarnation. And so I think when we ask the question of how we respond to culture, we've got to know our purpose in it is to redeem it. We have to know that that means that we can't run from it, but we engage it. We tell them what we stand for like Christ did, and that we remember above all things that we live out the incarnation, because that's what Christ did for you and me when he found us and saved us. That author has one quote that I really liked that I kind of want to end with. She says, "We could not become like God, so God became like us. God showed us how to heal instead of kill, how to mend instead of destroy, how to love instead of hate, how to live instead of long for more. When we nailed God to a tree, God forgave. And when we buried God in the ground, God got up." One of the beautiful things about being part of the church in our culture is we get the insane privilege of teaching the story of God to the people around us. And it's not black and white all the time. And that means that sometimes, you know, we fight battles that we lose, but we get to see God redeem. We get that responsibility and that beautiful task. One of the articles that I read, so you know, after the Supreme Court decision, the Christian South went crazy on every social media source ever, and everybody did, actually. So all these things were being posted. I think it was Christianity Today posted an article, and it had a lot of things to say, but one of them, it said, you know, hey, maybe now we can admit as a church that, hey, in the public forum, we've lost the debate or the war with the gay community, you know, in terms of the morality of it. Let's just say that we've lost it, and let's start being the church again. Maybe that's a positive from this. That we can stop saying how we need to legislate morality, and we can stop saying and being behavior police, and we can start loving again, drawing people close, and speaking into them about the life that Christ offers. Maybe this is the beginning of us being the church again and not worrying about the battle that's being fought somewhere else. I love that idea, that we draw people near. As ambassadors, we beg for them to know the goodness of God. That our role in culture isn't to watch it go to hell in a handbasket, to stand by and redeem it as Christ is redeeming all things and making all things new. Let me pray. God, I'm thankful, so incredibly thankful for the privilege you've given us as the church, as individuals that follow you. I'm thankful that we have the fantastic opportunity to show other people how great you are, to call people into a life that redeems, that changes motivations, and that reconciles back to its original intended created purpose. So God, I pray that you give us courage as we fight it, as we answer tough questions about what it looks like, as we have coffee and as we have dinners with people that probably don't believe the same thing we believe. Give us the courage and the wisdom to deal with that well. May we love well and stay away from trying to tell people what they're doing wrong, and instead telling people what Christ is going to do for them and will do for them. That they find life in the gospel. Give us the ability to speak that into our culture, that we might be seen as a light, man, as Christ talks about in Matthew, and that people might come to know that you redeem everything. In Christ's name, I pray.